Statewide satellite distribution of this program is made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.
This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Chartock of the State University.
Hello and welcome to the Legislative Gazette. This week, a prominent state senator calls for the Board of Regents to clean up its act. And Comptroller Regan says that lawmakers won't be able to put no-show employees on their payrolls anymore. Not with the new audits and guidelines booklet. We'll talk about a new literacy program for public unions. And we'll hear about a controversy at the Egg in Albany. It's one that isn't going over easy. All this and more, much more, coming up on this week's Legislative Gazette. There is high drama at the Empire State Institute for the Performing Arts, otherwise known as the Egg. But as Bruce Robertson tells us, no one is doing any acting.
Governor Rockefeller wanted to build a lecture hall at the sprawling South Mall of the state's capital. As plans developed, the hall expanded, becoming two theaters, a performing arts center. The facility is now simply called the Egg for its characteristic shape. The idea was, and still is, to provide a cultural center for New York. But there is trouble brewing, trouble that is drawing such epithets as the egg is cracking, or too many cooks in the soup, and the like.
You can't have one party making decisions on behalf of the other party without the two parties coming together and talking.
That's Patricia Snyder, director of the Empire State Institute for the Performing Arts at the Egg, talking about the mounting tension there today. More on that in a moment. The trouble really started in 1979 when the Egg was completed. Funded by taxpayers of New York State, the Egg was to be home of a wide variety of cultural activities, all managed by the Empire State Performing Arts Center Corporation. Into the new Egg came the State Youth Theater Institute, managed by Patricia Snyder. The Youth Theater began a very ambitious series of programs utilizing both the Egg's theaters. In 1982, the corporation merged with the Youth Theater and has become the Empire State Institute for the Performing Arts, or ESIPA. Although Snyder has brought a variety of other programs, the principal mission of ESIPA, with its backbone being the Youth Theater, is to present an educationally balanced program of entertainment for schoolchildren. The Youth Theater, and indeed ESIPA, now itself being an arm of the state university system. Until now, ESIPA has been the only tenant at the Egg. Enter Barnabas McHenry, president of the board of directors of the Plaza Corporation. McHenry was president of the Lincoln Center Theater Company in New York City until 1983, and during that time, the Vivian Beaumont Theater there had remained dark. When McHenry came to ESIPA, Snyder wondered whether he planned to run the Egg in a similar fashion. At a recent board of directors meeting, McHenry, in calling for increased use of the Egg, with programs added to those provided now only by ESIPA, explained that other nonprofit theaters do manage to put more on.
There are many other facilities such as this. You take the New York State Theater. The New York State Theater, in it has that's the home of two companies: the New York State, the New York City Ballet and the New York City Opera. And they put on 277 performances, I think is what it was. That's an incredible number of performances in that space. They're able to move, they're able to strike an opera and put a new one up. The time between the end of the opera and the beginning of the ballet is only 2 days. And it's possible to do these things.
And this is the fulcrum of the controversy. Snyder says ESIPA is already using the theaters to nearly full capacity, but McHenry pointed out that there is one way to create more available time and space, and this is to take the shows on the road.
The legislation creating the youth theater said they're supposed to tour. And they haven't toured. They're not touring now. They're not touring. They can find time to go to Jordan in the summer, but they can't find time to go to Ogdensburg or to Binghamton, or to Buffalo. And they toured to Moscow last year. And the Moscow Youth Theater is going to come here. People are asking these questions. These are not questions that I'm raising, but people are saying this.
But Snyder says there was no legislation, only a letter of agreement by which ACIPA was formed, an agreement giving the Youth Theater and ACIPA freedom to live and expand its programs and the corporation a similar freedom. Snyder says that something is changing. She doesn't know what, but to her it feels like McHenry is wanting to phase out ACIPA in favor of some other type of format at the Egg. McHenry is quite firm in saying that he supports and wants to keep ACIPA, wanting only to add more diversity to the programs offered at the Egg. Snyder, pointing to an already full agenda, feels that the only way McHenry will accomplish this is to phase out part of or all of ACIPA. Early next year, at the next board meeting, McHenry promises more information on where he'd like to go with ACIPA. Right now, though, it's intermission time. For the Legislative Gazette, this is Bruce Robertson.
1987 has been a year of turmoil for the New York State Legislature, with some indictments coming down and alleged corruption in both houses. But it's also been a year of ethical reform. Brenda McMahon has more.
It's been a tumultuous year for the state legislature, where it seems like the old saying, all politicians are corrupt, has been getting more support. But with all the indictments and the difficult times the legislature has gone through, there have been a number of ethical reforms as well. The passage of the ethics law, the creation of the Furyk Commission, which will investigate state government, and the audits and guidelines law. This week, culminating the year's events, State Comptroller Ed Regan and Governor Cuomo unveiled a booklet which outlines appropriate government behavior according to the Audit and Guidelines Law. 1,000 copies of the booklet will be distributed to state agencies and the legislature to be used as an official rule of thumb for state workers and legislators. Governor Cuomo says he hopes this booklet will make elected officials more accountable to the public.
We believe we should lead the nation in accountability. We should lead the nation in throwing off the, I hope this doesn't sound offensive, arrogant governmental assumption that the people have no right to know, that they'll only get in the way if you share all the information with them. We should reserve to ourselves as a government only what is absolutely essential to be kept secret. Beyond that, we should share as much as possible with the public at large.
The booklet is also expected to enforce fiscal integrity at all levels of government. Comptroller Regan says it will even help eliminate the problem of no-show employees.
First of all, there will be a classification system for the employee, defining the nature of that employee's duties and an assignment to a job that's appropriate for that employee's duties. And then there will be a standard system set up with hours worked, vacation time accumulated, sick leave, all of the standard procedures that all of us have in all of our operations to encourage and to verify that people are doing their assigned duties and doing them in the assigned hours.
A similar audits and guidelines booklet will be distributed to local governments for optional use. Regan says it's a good tool to run an efficient government. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Brenda McMahon.
Senator James Donovan, Republican chairman of the powerful Education Committee, says that the Board of Regents should have its term cut from 7 to 5 years. I spoke to the senator this week about his thoughts on restructuring the Board of Regents.
In my opinion, the Board of Regents has become politicized. So let me give you a couple of illustrations. A few years ago, the Board of Regents refused to establish an engineering course at New Paltz.
Boy, do I remember that as a faculty member at New Paltz.
Okay. The governor turned him around. Mm-hmm. The governor invaded the sanctuary of the Board of Regents and turned them around, and they reversed themselves and approved it. That was a bad move. They lost much of their good image on that score.
But from the other side, Jim, not to start a whole fight about that, here was the legislature and the governor saying it's appropriate that there be an engineering school in the Mid-Hudson Valley, even though the regents said no. And some people felt the regents were in the pockets of the private colleges at that stage.
Well, there's always an argument about maintaining a proper balance between the public and private universities
right.
in New York State. Now, my point is that once the regents had made their decision
yeah.
based on the information given to them by the experts in the education department and the universities, they said no. this is not a good educational decision. We should not create another engineering school at New Paltz. All right, that was their decision. We should have confidence in what they what the findings they make. But shortly thereafter, they're reversed. So let me go to another illustration.
Sure. We disagree on that one, but you know where I'm coming from. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
But you see, here's another another aspect of that New Paltz. If we're going to permit the governor of a state to intervene and countermand decisions of the Board of Regents, then we might as well do away with the Board of Regents and let the change our constitution and then let it flow through a legislative process.
Okay, why not?
Oh, no. No, I don't want to see that. I want as much political insulation and education that as we can get.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but it's very political when make a decision, for example, the Board of Regents, not to allow an engineering school in the Mid-Hudson Valley in the public sector. Why shouldn't a mama on Long Island write to her legislator and say, why doesn't my kid get a break, too?
Mm-hmm. I understand that. That's all part of democracy. Yeah. But let me go on with my thoughts on the board becoming politicized.
Sure.
Everybody in the legislature, under certain circumstances, can have one vote on an appointment of a regent to the board.
Yes.
The assembly has 150 members. The Senate has 61. Obviously, they got the votes to put whomever they want on the board.
Right. It's the only thing that both houses of the legislature end up sitting together with to decide, and everybody gets one vote. There are more votes in the assembly than in the Senate. Therefore, the assembly gets to call the shots.
That's right. Now, if we both houses agree on a particular appointee, then we adopt concurrent resolutions and we don't meet in a joint session.
But that hasn't been happening.
No. Now, taking this a step further, three appointments in the recent past in which the assembly prevailed resulted in the appointment of three former assemblymen to the Board of Regents.
Okay.
That illustrates to me that it's maybe becoming a good old boy club.
Right.
And this bothers me because I see those appointments being made, not that those persons are not committed and dedicated and hardworking, but I see other people equally qualified or maybe more qualified being passed over because we want to do something for one of our former members.
But if you were in the assembly and you had, as the chairman of the Education Committee, which you are in the Senate, the choice of drafting all of those regents, would you be calling for reform?
Probably not.
Okay. Now, because you believe you'd be doing it better, right?
Well, possibly.
So how would you change the way it's done now? What happens now to pick a regents, and what would you do?
Well, what happens now basically is that candidates come forward, whether they're incumbents or aspiring applicants, and the assembly usually will call a meeting that's usually closed, and they'll ask us if we want to come and participate, and that party will be asked a series of questions and think them for their coming, and then we'll let you know.
Just like what we would see in a Supreme Court, except that the press and the public would not be invited.
Yes, and not only that, but we want to expand the process to have the public come and be heard, the public come and speak.
About
the public have something to say about how they feel about the condition of education in New York State and how the regents function and who should or who shouldn't be a regent. I also want to bring the governor's office into this to some extent as well. The governor has rightfully expressed some disdain about what's going on across the street in the education department. I have a good working relationship with the governor, and I want him to have input into what we're opening up as well. We want to talk about trying to make the selection of regents a co-equal participation process where the Senate and the Assembly have equal voting power. We want to talk about reducing the size of the Board of Regents from its current 16-member board to something around, well, it's got to be at least nine.
That's what the Constitution
requires, that it be at least nine.
$5. If you had to put $5 of your own money on it, a year from now, will we see your reforms being adopted?
Yes, we will, because the time is right for reform. The situation that exists in New York City is disgraceful. We know that the Regents Action Plan has some glitches in it that the educational community are dissatisfied with. We see interest in vocational education and BOCES programs waning at a time when we need to train more people in a mm-hmm. sophisticated workforce. We just realize that they haven't really cut the mustard when it comes to the drugs that are in schools, the alcohol problems, dropout problem. They just haven't done anything right lately.
Senator James Donovan is chairman of the Senate Education Committee. Over 10 million people nationwide are illiterate, and at least 43% of the population ages 21 to 25 do not have sufficient literacy skills to handle multi-step directions. It's a serious problem in this country, but New York says it's tackling it head-on. Paul Rosenthal reports.
Education Commissioner Thomas Sobel and AFL-CIO union leaders recently implemented a new education program called Workplace Literacy. Workplace Literacy is the first of its kind in the nation, and it will teach over 9,000 union members basic literacy skills and other technical training on the job. Commissioner Sobel says this unique program teaches union members at the workplace. He says, according to the unions, some workers get time to study during the workday, while others can learn before or after work. But he says teaching at the workplace makes learning easier and more convenient.
The training experience will occur chiefly at the work site. So no longer does the worker have to complete a long day, go home, try to deal with family and other responsibilities, and then go out and find this education on his or her own in the evening or at some other time. The source of help will be immediately available right at the workplace itself.
Workplace Literacy is a six-month, $2 million pilot program funded by the state legislature. Sobel says illiteracy has soared in New York, in part because of the increased immigration.
One of the realities, by the way, is that the country is now experiencing a wave of immigration, which is without parallel until you go back to the beginning of the century. We are trying to assimilate numbers of people foreign to these shores, equivalent to what occurred in the country back at the turn of the century. Many of these people come without English as a native language. They are struggling to work in the workplace, and this program will help them tremendously.
The commissioner says educators, union leaders, and business are working together on workplace literacy, adding time, facilities, and expertise when and where necessary. 11 projects have been awarded across the state. Half of them are in the New York City area, and the others are scattered among upstate and western New York. If workplace literacy is a success, unions are hoping to refund and expand the program. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Paul Rosenthal.
The Thierich Commission is an anti-corruption group which was established to look into all operations of state and local government. I spoke with Fred Dicker, Capitol Bureau Chief from the New York Post, about the commission. Fred Dicker of the New York Post, happy holidays.
To you too, Alan. Feliz Navidad, happy Hanukkah, and a good new year.
Fred, the Thierich Commission, the Commission on the Integrity in Government, has now reported its preliminary findings.
Yeah.
What do they want?
Well, basically, it's a rehash of what we've been hearing for the last couple of years. They want changes in what they describe quite correctly, Alan. I think we both agree in the states, to use their words, embarrassing political system, which allows tremendous amounts of money from special interest groups to at least appear to have undue influence on lawmakers. They want changes in that. They talk about an optional system of public financing, a sharply reduced threshold or limit on the amount of money that any individual or corporation or union could contribute. And they want more openness so that we have a state board of elections which actually aggressively makes sure the law is enforced, as opposed to the one we have now, which is barely able to keep its head above water. They want across-the-board reforms, as did the Sovereign Commission, which preceded it, as has Mario Cuomo for several years. And unfortunately, the chances for this kind of across-the-board reform don't appear right now, in my judgment, to be any greater today than it was a year ago or 2 years ago.
Freddie, I noticed that the commission, when they called for campaign financing, called for the major statewide offices, but
yes,
not for the legislature. It seems to me that the legislature is where they're really getting away with murder and where really we have to get some kind of handle on who's giving them money and for what.
You're right, Alan, but let's keep in mind that just a few months ago, the Senate Majority Leader, Warren Anderson, in a communication to this commission, which after all is a creation of both the legislature and the governor, made clear he looked askance at the possibility of trying to impose a system of public financing on the 211 legislative races. I suspect, and this is, I think, an understandable position, that pragmatically this commission, headed by John Furyk, the Fordham Law School dean, decided let's try to get something rather than try to get everything. Start with the statewide offices, which would be governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and controller, and if we can succeed in getting that, then we'll move on to the legislative races.
Okay, Fred, this is a year of predictions. It's a time of predictions, New Year's. I name some names, and you tell me what you think are coming for them, okay?
Sure.
All right, Mario Cuomo.
Well, I think that he'll continue to be the hottest Democratic property in the nation through the Democratic primary period, and come June and July, we'll still have a chance of being drafted at the Democratic primary, Democratic convention, as a Democratic presidential candidate.
Rudolph Giuliani.
Ambivalent now, doesn't know whether he should run against Pat Moynihan or not, will ultimately decide not to do it.
Andrew Cuomo.
Andrew Cuomo continues to be a key aide to the governor, occasionally coming under scrutiny, as he did this week, and in some cases some embarrassing scrutiny, but ultimately will be shown to be an honest and decent individual.
Bobby Abrams.
Continues to just hold his breath, hoping Mario Cuomo becomes president, because right now he's got the inside track to be the next governor of New York.
Fred Dicker.
Tries as much as possible to continue to be a fair, objective observer of a system which I continue to marvel at in its complexity and which clearly is in need of change and reform, and I hope what I do in the coming year can contribute to some of that. Yeah. Alan Shartok.
Alan Shartok just gets on knees and hope and will continue to hope every morning that he can make it through the day. Warren Anderson.
Warren Anderson. Will once again play the game of trying to decide should he run for re-election or not, will come under more pressure than ever before from his younger members who suggest that he's not as effective a leader as he should be, but that when push comes to shove, he will seek re-election because basically Warren Anderson likes the social life and the attention he gets here. He's not doing it, in my judgment, for the ideology, but for the personal satisfaction.
The Long Island Republicans.
An increasingly powerful force which will flex its muscle more in the coming year than it's ever done before.
And trouble for Warren Anderson.
Yes, we're talking about the Long Island Senate Republicans.
Right, okay. Let's see.
Melvin
Miller.
He's given one more chance to prove he can be a good Assembly Speaker. If he fails, there'll be an open challenge to him in the Assembly Democratic Conference.
From who?
From, I don't know yet, it'll be, neither house of this legislature, as we both know, Alan, is identified with having strong political courage on the part of its members, so the opposition to Miller, should it develop, as I think it will if he doesn't do well, will start secretly. It'll mean a coalition of upstaters and probably some non-Brooklyn, New York City people, but right now no names will be associated with it.
Stan Lundin.
Stan Lundin will continue to be everybody's favorite lieutenant governor with no chance at all of ever becoming governor.
Fred Dicker of the New York Post. This week, Congress passed a comprehensive budget bill in the wee hours of a session. Several congressmen criticized the process, saying legislators didn't have time to read the huge document before they voted on it. Dave Gillette asked Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundin, a former congressman, about this process.
We've had the vision of the Congress and some congressmen, notably Massachusetts veteran Congressman Silvio Conti, getting up on the floor of the House, waving the hundreds of pages of the budget bill, saying that nobody knows what's in it. Now, you've had experience on both sides of that now. That comment has been made of the New York State Legislature from time to time. Is there any way to inspire confidence among our legislators?
No, I think that's a very good point, Dave. When we talk about government integrity, we're not just talking about politicians staying out of jail or being honest or disclosing their personal finances. The way we do business, the way we set the policies for this country or for this state, is also important. And I think Congress does make a fool out of itself passing $600 billion of authorizations all at the same time, 2.5 months late, on Christmas Eve practically, when they don't know what's in the bill. Similarly, the state legislature, when they passed two-thirds of all their legislation in the last week, is obviously not doing a deliberative job. I think this next couple of days, the governor's going to have to make a decision about vetoing a bill that passed the legislature virtually unanimously because the legislators are now telling us they didn't know what was in the bill when they passed it and they want to take another look at it. And that's probably the truth. So you're absolutely right. The way we go about legislating, the way we go about making public policies, the integrity of that process is also important to people's confidence in government.
Any resolutions coming up for the new year?
I haven't even had time to think about them. We've been so busy working on the state budget and the State of the State address. That's our official Family of New York resolutions for the new year that I haven't had time to think about any personal ones, but I suppose that I'll use the same ones that most people do to lose some weight and all those good things.
Some sources are saying that you'd like to have some more staff and office space.
No, that's not true at all. I like having a small staff, no supervisory problems and all that. We took a long time for us to get office space because we wanted my staff to be right with the governor's staff on the second floor of the Capitol, even though my own office is up on the third floor adjacent to the state Senate. And that meant moving people out and changing space. But now we're settled and we're very happy. I have a small staff so that the governor's staff will feel responsive to me, and it's worked out really well.
Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen. And that's it for this week's Legislative Gazette. The show was produced by Brenda McMahon, and she had help this week from Paul Rosenthal, Bruce Robertson, and Dave Gillette. I hope you enjoyed the show, that you'll have a happy holiday, and that you'll tune in again next week to hear about the news and events in and around the Empire State. Until then, I'm Alan Chartok.
Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University College at New Paltz.
Statewide satellite distribution of this program was made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.